Greetings. This is David Fuller of the Fuller Money Global Strategy Service, recording a special audio to accompany my presentation at the 48th Annual Contrary Opinion Forum held at Basin Harbor in Vermont from the 6th through the 8th of October 2010. As an aside, I recommend the Contrary Opinion Forum to investors. This was the second time that I have attended and participated in this conference, which is mercifully free of commercial hype. Alex Siegel and his colleagues at Fraser Asset Management put on a very good show, and what I particularly value is all the quiet discussion time during meals and receptions with delegates. Many of whom are most experienced investors in their own right. Now, on to the presentation and the two globes on this opening slide. The one on the left shows the United States front and center because it was the engine of global economic development in the last century. If we went back 200 years, the United Kingdom would have been at the center. Today, it's the Asian region, including the subcontinent, which is now the engine of global GDP growth. Turning to the second slide, I have often felt that the various descriptions used to describe regions of the world in economic terms were inadequate. You know, the old world, new world, emerging markets, developing or developed. I don't think these stand the test of time and are certainly outdated today. So I think of it very much on the basis of what do all economies have in common. And in my opinion, we can summarize it by saying that they are either progressing or regressing. Now that requires a little bit of explanation. And it also is, to a certain degree, in the eye of the beholder. In other words, think of it as a glass being either half full or half empty. If we feel the glass is half empty, we're probably worried about that market and would hope to avoid it. On the other hand, if we feel that the glass is half full, then we are going to be more interested in it. And it's the trend that we see in terms of progression or regression that will influence investors. Another way to look at this, in a tongue-in-cheek comment, if you tell your wife that she looks like the first day of spring, you'll get a different response than if you tell her she looks like the last day of winter, although they are both the same days. Now, investors, not surprisingly, are going to be more interested in investing in progressing economies than in regressing economies, and the price action will be one of the factors that will convince them, and we will be studying that in a moment in this presentation. Now, progressing economies, in my opinion, have a number of characteristics about which we can be really quite precise. And I'm looking at the third slide right now where I have listed various different factors. And you can run down that list and really apply them to many of the economies around the world today. And I don't think it's terribly subjective to assess countries on this basis. Turning to the next slide, the fourth slide, regressing economies really have a governance that is actually backsliding. And I think that, again, this is should be viewed on a relative comparison basis. I've often said this, and really because at Fuller Money, we feel that for investors, the world is really world of investment is really a global beauty contest. And where we feel that governance is improving, albeit from a very low level, that probably indicates potential, as long as that trend of governance is improving. On the other hand, if it is deteriorating, that's very much of a problem for investors. Looking at the fifth slide and emphasizing governance once again, let's have some examples. I feel, for example, that Singapore, and I'm going to talk about economic governance, and I want to emphasize that point, economic governance. I have long felt that Singapore has had the best economic governance of any country, and I would say that it really applies to the last 40 years. Now, some of what I'm about to say may be a little bit controversial, but I do feel that standards of economic governance in the United States have slipped over at least the last 15 years. In the United Kingdom, where I live, that has also been true, although I'm optimistic that standards of economic governance are now beginning to improve once again following the election of the coalition government. Asia. Seared by the Asian financial crisis in 1997 and 1998, has improved its economic governance immeasurably. Similarly, South American economies, following the severe inflation problems that they have experienced in the past over so many decades, has now improved its governance immeasurably. There's also a luck factor because they have resources, and the strong dynamic economies of the Asian region are the major clients for those agricultural and industrial resources. Now, how do countries go from progressing to regressing? Well, most of the problems, as you can see looking down this list, involve self-inflicted wounds. And I would also mention that no country is likely to remain permanently in a progressing or regressing state. There are cycles. There are cycles for countries, just as there are cycles in markets. And we do see change over the medium to longer term. And again, I emphasize the relative change that is most important of all. My own view, and I can let viewers of this presentation do their own classifications, but I'll just say that in my own view, the OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Countries, that's mostly North America plus Japan and Europe, that governance, or I should say that the economies have suffered some regression over that period, often due to difficulties or problems of governance. I would also say that in what are called the emerging economies by many other people, have seen an improvement in governance, and that they are in the progressing zone. And we'll have specific examples in this presentation. But first, looking at the seventh slide, I pose what I feel is an important question for investors, particularly investors in the United States and who live in the United States and in the European region. And that question is, do two severe bear markets within 8 years make it more or less likely that another dramatic decline will occur in the next few years? Well, let's talk about sentiment again. The perception for investors very often is to expect a repeat of the last really dramatic event in their financial lives. And investors were battered by those two big bear market declines, starting in 2000 as the tech and telecoms bubble burst, and then the credit crisis slump as the U.S. banking excesses, which had spread around to other regions of the world, of course, certainly including Europe, led to a significant financial crisis. Now, as I say, in terms of perceptions, people are always looking over their shoulder, fearing a repeat of a similar event. Whereas, historically, I would argue that these searing experiences bring about changes and also lower valuations, which make the future more optimistic than people dare hope in the first few years of recovery. And I think this applies to stock markets today. Now, the next slide, number 8, shows the Standard & Poor's 500 index since 1953. And you'll see two boxes around regions of trading in the notes. And the first one, 1967 to 1982 period, and I mean, I joined the global financial industry at the beginning of my financial career. I actually started in 1967, and I thought stock markets always went up at that time, and it was a steep learning curve for me and many other investors, because we had this long-ranging period that followed, characterized by a contraction in valuations. And in Standard & Poor's 500 terms, for instance, the yield moved progressively higher during that period, and reaching a peak of 6.21% in the first, in the second quarter of 1982, because basically investors were disillusioned with equities. You can see that the actual price trend was not moving downwards throughout that period, but there were two quite sharp bear markets. Not least the one that occurred during 1973 and 1974. And when I look at the box to the right, I wonder if we haven't seen something really quite similar. There you can see the first big bear market commencing in 2000 and running into 2001. And then the even bigger one with that panic in 2000, in the fourth quarter of 2008, and then revisited in the first quarter of 2009 for the S&P, creating a lower low. And I'm struck by the possibilities that that's very similar to what we saw back in that earlier period between 1970 and the beginning of 1975, and that earlier secular valuation contraction. And I pose the question, which is very much a guess, will we remain in this period of gradually improving valuations, but with the S&P really locked in a trading range until approximately 2015, as I say, that year? It's very much a guess, because no one knows for sure what the future holds. But my hunch is that we are locked in a trading range, and that that is exactly what's taking place, and that this trading range will eventually be resolved by another move to the upside. Now, it's not just because I have a sunny disposition that I say that, but you look at what's changing in terms of economic governance for companies and the way they went into survival mode during the last crisis in particular, following, as I say, that very severe bear market decline in 2008 and early 2009. And they shed overheads, they've produced, increased their overall efficiency, and not just via layoffs, but also now we're seeing the upgrading of technology in many of these companies, and I think that and we're also seeing dividend increases once again, because their corporate profits are improving, their balance sheets are much stronger, and there's something like 1.7 trillion cash on the balance sheets of U.S. Multinational companies. Okay, moving on to the ninth slide. Investors are emotional when they become part of the crowd of overall investors. And what I'm trying to say is that when we invest, when we step into the market, we become part of that overall crowd psychology. And markets have a history of being manic, depressive in their swings. And this has been something that's gone on since as long as there have been markets, and I dare say it will go on for a very long time in the future. But the point that I'm referring to specifically concerns all the forecasts of a depression that we hear in the United States. Since I've had a reasonably long financial career, I can recall distinctly when we've heard this in other cycles, not least, but not exclusively, but not least in 1974, 1987 following the crash, and also in 2001. Now, I do feel that this crisis is more serious in the West, but that is not the case everywhere else. And moving on to the 10th slide, what we actually are seeing is, as I'm sure you're aware, a very severe credit crisis recession, and I do feel that it is the worst since the 1930s. But the 10th slide also shows what I've put in inverted commas, because this is not my own research, although it certainly coincides with what I have experienced during my 45 years in markets. But it is also based on some very good research from a number of different people that I have seen, and people whom I respect. And the important point is that 100 years of history show that it takes from 5 to 7 years for an economy to recover from a credit crisis recession. And we are just entering the third year in the West. Now, if you think back to the previous credit crisis recession, and they have occurred regularly throughout the globe, the last really important one prior to this one was the Asian financial crisis, which I referred to earlier on. Okay, currently, the U.S. economy has avoided that double-dip recession that so many people had forecast, and I think that part of this is due to the very accommodative monetary policies that we've seen, but I think it also owes something to the very strong Asian-led GDP growth. Now, so many investors, not least economists, have been saying that with the U.S. economy still in clear trouble in terms of overall economic problems, why shouldn't, and we see the evidence of that all around us in terms of high unemployment figures, but why should the Or why shouldn't the Standard & Poor's 500 index fall to new lows, as many people have actually forecast? Well, for a number of months, I've been saying you don't buy the economy when you invest in the stock market. You buy individual companies, and they're not all one and the same. I like the way Russell Napier summed it up. He's a fine strategist based in Asia with CLSA. And, of course, you can see it. It's not about the economy, stupid, were his words. Think about that. Now, I also want to see the actual evidence from markets, because at Fuller Money, we don't attempt to tell the market what to do. I think of my own approach, and I've often described it as that of a naturalist, not a naturist. Those are people who take their clothes off, but as a naturalist. Think of David Attenborough peering through the shrubs to seeing what the herd of antelope or other animals or whatever other animals that he might be watching are actually doing. And I spend a lot of time, my time, doing that, looking at charts. And I start with this chart of the NASDAQ 100 index. And there's no way that one can look at that chart and say that we are in a bear market. In my view, that chart says that we are in at least a cyclical bull market. Now, the big debate in investment has been between bonds and equities, and actually, maybe it's been less of a debate given the given what investors have actually done, because they have poured. If you look at slide number 13, bonds or equities, investors have poured a huge amount of money. As of the last statistics that I saw, $175 billion into bond funds in the United States, while at the same time pulling $35 billion out of stock market funds. Now, interestingly, the stock market has still managed to rise despite that selling by mutual fund investors. And that tells us something about the supply of equities relative to the demand on a worldwide basis. But let's focus on these bond investments, because unfortunately, the crowd of investors is usually wrong at the extremes. So my concluding question on this slide is, does that make sense in today's economic environment? Well, have a look at what the market's done and turn to slide number 14. Now, I remember that period in 1981 when we saw bond yields spike, and not just in the United States, but pretty much all over the world. And during that period, many investors were quite fearful in terms of buying bonds, despite these massive yields. But the norm was for people to say, well, and I won't take them right up at the peak, but when bond yields, and we're looking at a chart of the 10-year, U.S. 10-year Treasury bond yield, but when bond yields were at 13, 14, 15, yielding 13, 14, 15% per annum, investors were saying, well, no, I wouldn't touch them because they might yield 16 or 17 or even 20%. Well, you can see where they peaked, just below 16, just below 16%. They moved even higher in the United Kingdom. But any way you look at it, that's a quite spectacular yield, and that offsets a fair amount of inflation. at a time when the United States was moving quite aggressively to reduce inflation in the economy, and as were other economies. But the point is the behavioral one. Investors were afraid to invest in bonds back then, although the shrewd ones actually did and did extremely well. Well, look at bond yields more recently. And historically, they're exceptionally low. This chart goes back to 1962, which is the extent of the data that I had in our data banks. Now, does it make sense to buy down at these yields? Well, in terms of the historic picture, I would say most definitely not, unless investors feel that we really are going to repeat the Japanese experience and see a major deflationary environment and possibly an overall depression environment. Well, more on that subject in a minute. But the next slide, number 15, I mentioned that I produced this quote, this fine quote, I think from Mike Leonhoff of Bruin Dolphin Securities, who I know, and I post his reports on a fairly regular basis. But I'll just read out this quote, although you can obviously see it, but the bond markets are taking their cue from the developed economies. Now, the point that I want to emphasize on this is the astute observation regarding psychology. An investor with a portfolio entirely of bonds, for instance, has a vested interest in low growth and deflationary pressures. Otherwise, why hold bonds at these low historical yields? Conversely, investors in equities, and clearly from the price trends, some of which you will see in a moment, given the performance, the outperformance of many of the progressing economies, and these will be from Asia to South America, investors are really focusing not on the U.S. so much, or on Europe, but on these emerging, developing, or what I prefer to call progressing regions. And they're the ones that have shown the top overall performance. Now let's look at slide number 16, and it's the only slide that I will show that, a graphic slide that I will show that doesn't come directly from Fuller Money, but this was produced by Standard & Poor's. And that just shows the risk premium and really that equity operating earnings, and this is based on U.S. Standard & Poor's 500 operating earnings, are really at a very attractive level relative to 10-year U.S. Treasury yields. And so the bottom line on this is that equities are more competitive on this basis relative to long-dated government bonds than at any time for a number of decades. Some people say up to 50 years or so. Look at the next slide, number 17. And I just quoted a short section from a report in the Financial Times here. But this astonishing environment is enabling companies, some with not very attractive credit ratings, such as the BAA rating shown here in the opening sentence, and this company is able to borrow for 100 years paying an interest rate of only 5.59%. Now, that to me is quite exceptional, almost unprecedented. And then take a smart company like Microsoft, which has lots and lots of cash. Well, Microsoft recently borrowed $2.5 billion, I think it was over 10 years, not because they needed the money, they don't, but because they could borrow so cheaply. Now, Microsoft and a good many other companies with quite strong balance sheets have been doing the same thing, not because they need the money, but because they feel very strongly that these historic low yields are not going to persist, so better to borrow now when costs of financing are low, and then they can use the capital whenever they might wish to. Look at slide number 18, going back to stock market sentiment. Now, up until recently, sentiment in the West, at any rate, had been extremely pessimistic as far as equities were concerned. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. You know, the press isn't in the business of telling you which cats did not get stuck up trees today. The frightening stories undoubtedly sell more newspapers. So they tend to focus on some of the market forecasts that are particularly bearish, and there have been no shortage of those. Now, there's also a little bit of mischief involved sometimes, in that if we have some fairly aggressive short positions established by financial institutions, and they have a vested interest in talking their book. Well, I don't want to just single them out. Everybody talks their book. But this combination of pessimism, fear of a repeat of the two crashes that we saw in 2000 and 2001 and the 2008-9, early 2009 decline, have prompted what I have often described as irrational pessimism and even gratuitous gloom. The death crosses requires a little bit of explanation. That's a colorful term for when the 50-day moving average crosses beneath a declining 200-day moving average. And there were a few of those because markets had recovered so quickly following the March 2009 low that by September of and October of that year, 2009, that the recoveries had been so dramatic that markets were quite overextended in the short term, and that led to a reassessment and lengthy consolidation of gains until September for developed markets, and a little earlier for some of the other markets around the world when they resumed their recoveries. I quote an extremely bearish forecast, which seemed a lot of received a lot of attention, and I won't even go into a discussion of the Hindenburg omen. It speaks for itself. Meanwhile, though, we have seen some very dramatic improvements by a number of stock markets around the world, and have a look, for instance, at slide number 19. Showing the stock market performance of Indonesia going back to 1989. I refer to this as a Brobdingnagian base. That, of course, is a reference to the Land of Giants in Jonathan Swift's wonderful book, Gulliver's Travels. And I'm referring, of course, to that long, big base formation that formed since before 1989 and right on into 2003 before that stock market began to break up out of that overall pattern. And this is one of the key leaders in the Asian stock market region, but one of many, I should say. Now let's look at slide 20. And a very important event occurred in June. And you'll see that purple vertical line that I've drawn, and there's an arrow pointing to it. And what you're looking at here, of course, is another chart of Indonesia, and it's representative of the ASEAN stock market group. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And the green line is a chart of the, it's an overlay chart of the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And we saw some uncoupling there, and quite dramatic uncoupling, because when Wall Street went down to its July low for the year, the Indonesian market and the ASEAN group in general, and also the leading South American stock markets, were actually moving higher. Now, uncoupling is something that strategists have talked about for decades, uncoupling from Wall Street. It had been a pipe dream for the most part. But I have never assumed that the U.S. would always drag stock, the rest of the world stock markets either up or down in its wake. I've often referred to the Wall Street leash effect, and that still is evident because the, more often than not, because the USA is still the biggest capitalization stock market by a considerable margin. But this is changing, and the U.S. will always be an important stock market, I suspect, but the increase in the values of other stock markets with the stronger growth rates is very dramatic. And what it's doing, basically, is diluting that Wall Street influence somewhat, and it is increasing the likelihood of uncoupling, such as what you see on this chart. And why will that occur? Because, you know, the U.S. unemployment figures and the U.S. Crisis of derivatives and the housing market really are not relevant to many of the world's other economies and stock markets. So they're concentrating on developments in their own countries, and for Indonesia and a good many of these other countries, that's been quite strong GDP growth and relatively low unemployment. And while people in the U.S. were talking about a depression, possible depression, these progressing economies that I'm referring to did not even experience a recession. That's the important point. Next slide, number 21, Thailand. Now, we don't need to spend long on this, but you see another very large base formation, the recovery really dating back to the lows from that Asian financial crisis, the recovery dramatically interrupted by the stock market crash in 2008. But incidentally, this market, as did Indonesia before it, they hit their lows back in October and November of 2008. And it did not go down to a new low as the S&P did, so we saw some uncoupling then as well. Now, let's look at slide number 22, Singapore, which I describe as the new Switzerland. This is typical of some of the, not the very front-running chart patterns that we actually see around the globe, but you see that long trading range that I referred to following the extremely dramatic recovery from the from the actual stock market lows. And you'll notice I use on these charts, I use a 200-day moving average. And I don't use it so much on a crossover basis, but I use it on a mean reversion basis. And it's a tactic that we emphasize at Fuller Money in terms of perspective. Now, for instance, you'll notice that you see a portion of the last bull market cycle, which began in 2003, but this chart picks it up. That's a five-year chart, so it's picking it up in mid-2005. But you'll see when it pulls up away from that 200-day moving average, becomes a little overextended, it's vulnerable to a reversion to the mean. And that happened several times, including in 2004 and 2005. Equally, when the bear market was commencing and finally broke down and stayed below the 200-day moving average, it then turned down, you'll notice that we get, after an initial sharp fall, we get some mean reversion back closer to the moving average, then it falls away again. Well, and becoming very overextended in that climactic selling phase. Incidentally, that's when I was giving my, back in October 2008, when I was giving my first speech at the Contrary Opinion Forum, and you can find the presentation of that session, of that speech, on the Fuller Money website in the presentations section. It does not have an accompanying audio, but you can turn to the last, you can review the charts, obviously all the slides, and see the three concluding forecasts on the last pages, 38 to 40 of that report. But talking about this dramatic downward acceleration, setting the market up for a recovery. Panic sell-offs are the ending of bear markets, and the ending of a bear market is always the beginning of at least a new cyclical bull market. And from Singapore's chart, you can see that this had broken upwards again ahead of Wall Street, resuming its cyclical bull market. And 23rd slide, China. And this is the China Shanghai A-share index. And this is quite interesting because China is not only now the world's second largest economy, but it is an economy that's having a huge influence on global trends, both economic and inflationary trends, and affecting commodity prices and so on. More on that in a moment. You'll notice that China, again, bottoming out in that October-November period, and when Wall Street was going down to its additional low back in first quarter of 2009, China was already consolidating above that small base formation. But it ran into trouble in July and August of 2009. And there was a very good reason for that, because China, like all other governments, pumped a huge amount of liquidity into the financial system because they were worried about recession and all the depression talk that had, was taking place. But China's economy never slipped into recession. Its growth only pulled back very briefly to, I think, around the 6 to 7% per annum level before jumping straight back up to the 9, 10% region. And all that liquidity sloshing around was creating another property bubble. And China had diffused its earlier property bubble back in 2007. by tightening monetary conditions. And it did so again, but in a different fashion. What it did is bump up the reserve requirements for Chinese banks. And that led to a great deal of stock market supply in the form of initial public offerings, IPOs, and also huge secondary offerings. And there were more of those occurring in China, twice the volume occurring in China, if you include Hong Kong, than what we were seeing on Wall Street throughout that period. And it's all about supply and demand in the stock market, plus sentiment, and the supply was clearly increasing over that period. Well, this is beginning to change, because China required banks to increase their reserved requirements so that they could finance, without additional funding, a benchmark figure involving a 60% correction in property values. Now, that was not a forecast. That's not something that I expect. That's not something that the Chinese government expects. But it was the extent of their reserve requirements. Now, the overall bottom line message of this is that China's government has been, in my opinion, quite fiscally responsible in requiring the banks to increase their reserve requirements dramatically. That way China is avoiding the banking collapses that we've seen and the ongoing banking problems that we've seen in some other countries that that we could cite. I think, now, but point I want to end on here with this slide is that this process of initial and secondary offerings is now drying up, and China is one of the cheaper progressing markets right now, and I think that the next recovery is underway. Incidentally, as you can see on this graph, we can just get a hint of this, that China was a late participant in the previous bull market cycle. Didn't its stock market basically range sideways from that 2003, 4, and 5 period and didn't take off until 2006? And I think this whole pattern is a big extended base formation, and that China will be one of the top performers. But this is the, emphasize that this is the China A-share index. Few Westerners invest in the A-shares. It's not that easy to do, and there's been no real reason why we should or should want to. But if you look at the next slide, number 24, you'll see the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index, where Westerners do indeed invest, and this has been breaking up out of this overall trading range, and I think well, by this time next year, I wouldn't be surprised if that isn't a lot closer to the 30,000 level and that high back in 2007 than current levels. Moving on to slide number 25, the Vietnam Stock Market Index. Investors, institutional investors, pay a great deal of attention to currencies in their portfolio allocations. And Vietnam is really more of a frontier market, but it's a very interesting one, and it's now a very competitive one. Vietnam has the lowest stock market valuations in Asia, and I think this is also an extended base formation, and that Vietnam is a very good medium to longer term recovery candidate. If you look at slide 26, you'll see very quickly why people have shunned Vietnam over the last couple of years. And this is a chart of the Vietnamese currency, the dong. And what you see is the U.S. dollar rising against the Vietnamese dong. Excuse me. Now, in other words, the Vietnamese have been devaluing their currency, and they started doing this in April, May 2008 in a progressive series of steps. And they've done this to increase their competitive position. Needless to say, this devaluation has created some short-term inflationary problems, and that inflation is a risk and is a problem throughout Asian region generally. But the weaker currency certainly doesn't help in that respect. Now, my own view, let's have a sip of water. My own view is that this devaluation is mostly over. And as I say, it's a policy, it's a government policy to devalue the dong. I think we're near the end of this overall devaluation. There's no need for it to really carry on further. But the upshot of all this is that Vietnam is now attracting an increasing amount of foreign investment, and it's a very, very cheap, competitive manufacturing sector in Asia. And it's also a less expensive tourist destination as a result of this. Now, the history of progressing emerging markets is that they can range for several years and then take off with quite significant moves. And I think that's what will happen with Vietnam over the next 5 years or so. Next slide, number 27. India, which is really my favorite or at least co-favorite BRIC stock market. India's valuations are on the higher side of average within the Asian region. They're not at historical highs for India, but they are what I've, as I mentioned, they're on a relative high basis, and the index is also back up near its previous peak, as you can see, and up near that 20,000 psychological level. So I think we're quite likely to see a further ranging consolidation near current levels that allows valuations to catch up somewhat. I don't think we'll see a big pullback. We may see a modest pullback. And I think that would be a buying opportunity. Any mean reversion towards a rising 200-day moving average would be attractive in my opinion. And this is a core position, India, in my long-term portfolio. Now, Bombay Banks Index, slide number 28, just to let you see what a healthy bank sector looks like. Not all countries around the world are experiencing chronic banking problems. And indeed, at Fuller Money, we look at banks as an important and often leading indicator for markets. And a weak, underperforming banking sector is a headwind for the broader stock market, just as a strong, performing banking sector is a bull signal for the broader market in other countries. Now, slide number 29 shows a chart of Chile. You can see plenty of uncoupling there from Wall Street. The stock market bottom in October 2008, and then look at the dramatic recovery that has occurred. This is a leading supplier of copper and other commodities, of course. You'll notice that it has pulled up rather far against it's looking overstretched relative to the 200-day moving average. So we do expect some mean reversion to occur, whether that mean reversion is mostly sideways, as we've seen so far, or involves a pullback. Usually it's a combination of both. I think that we're unlikely to see more than mean reversion towards the moving average. And the importance of this chart is, again, it's been one of the key leaders and enabling us to be really more optimistic about some of the lagging stock markets, because we could see the earlier breakouts occurring in Asian markets and in a number of South American stock markets. The only other one that I'll show from that region is the Brazilian market, but in our chart library at Fuller Money, and as part of the Fuller Money service, of course, we have a vast chart library which subscribers access whenever they wish to, and it's a customizable chart library. So you can show line charts or line and bar charts or candlestick charts, as you're seeing with this slide number 30 of Brazil. Brazil is, of course, a very major exporter of both industrial and agricultural commodities. It's also self-sufficient in energy. It has a lot of offshore oil, which will not be developed for several more years, but it's a resources-rich economy. And therefore, it is a leading exporter to China. Indeed, China imports most of Brazil's exports, and that demand from China has certainly given a major boost to the Brazilian economy, and that's something that I do not see changing anytime soon. And so there's an obvious relationship between the fortunes of Brazil and those of China, and it's still a pretty bullish overall picture. The next slide, a European stock market, the German DAX index. Again, you see this mean reversion, lengthy ranging process with the DAX index testing the upper side of that range, and it is subsequently broken up, reaffirming that overall cyclical bull run. Canada did it a little earlier, leading resources producer, as you can see from slide number 32. Slide number 33, here's the Standard & Poor's 500 index, and shown on a five-year chart basis. Now, interestingly, back in August, an associate firm of ours, Investors Intelligence, produces the advisor sentiment statistics that are often quoted. And the advisor sentiment statistics in late August were the most bearish since the March 2009 lows. And we commented on that, and as did Investors Intelligence, obviously, and that was a contrary indicator. In other words, sentiment is always at its most bearish at important market low points, and it's at its most bullish at important market peaks. Talk of the death crosses and extreme downside forecasts on Wall Street, the Hindenburg omen, all that colorful stuff. Well, September turned out to be the best, to record the best gains on Wall Street since 1939. And that doesn't sound like a secular bear market to me. I beg your pardon, doesn't sound like a market that's likely to return to its lows. A secular bear market can mean different things. It can mean valuation contraction. But I see no evidence. The important point is I see no evidence that Wall Street's going to go back and retest its 2009 lows. Okay, on currencies, and a quick review here. All fiat money currencies are being devalued in the sense that their central banks just keep printing them. No fiat currency has ever maintained its purchasing power over the longer term, but the least bad in this group have been the Swiss franc and the Singapore dollar. The resources-producing economies have generally tended to be a bit firmer than the debtor currencies, and the debtor currencies have been the U.S. dollar, sterling, the euro as well in this cycle. Looking at slide 35, there's the Asian dollar index, and I think that chart speaks for itself, that Asian countries will not want to see their currencies move upwards too rapidly. You certainly know that from all the discussion over China's currency. But on a long-term basis, I think that they will continue to outperform many of the Western currencies, but they will not outperform, for instance, gold, which I will come on to in a few moments. Now, this next chart, number 36, you can see the Singapore dollar against the U.S. dollar, and that's the U.S. dollar breaking down to new all-time lows against the Singapore dollar. Commodities, slide number 37, and we're getting into some of the summary views here. A long-standing, almost mantra at Fuller Money has been that we're in a secular bull market in commodities, and we describe that as supply and elasticity meets rising demand. Supply and elasticity in that it's not always that easy to increase production, but demand, led by China, continues to rise. Gold is a well-known story generally. It wasn't back in 2001 when we began to make this point, but certainly gold is once again widely regarded as hard money and a safe store of wealth. And gold has been around for longer than we've had investors, and it has outlived every fiat currency, and no doubt will continue to do so. Commodity price inflation, this is an important story, and an opportunity if you invest in some commodity shares and or trade any of the commodity markets, but it's also a growing risk, as you'll see in a moment. I look at slide number 38. And this is the old CRB index. It's unweighted, and it has more components than any of the others, so I tend to prefer it because it gives us, a clearer picture of what's going on overall than the weighted indices. And what I see is just a temporary interruption of what is likely to be a secular bull market. Slide number 39, gold. This is a monthly chart over 10 years, and there's been a very interesting phenomenon in that every other year we've seen important breakouts in September, and you see it from 01, 03, 05, 07, and 09. The gains are less apparent in the even-numbered years during that overall rise, although they did occur in 02, and they also occurred in 04, and to a lesser extent in 06. But we seem to be reverting back to that that earlier pattern, and gold remains quite strong here at the moment. So we may be in a period when its rate of advance will start to increase somewhat overall. What we want to look out for, which would be an eventual danger signal, would be a dramatic upward acceleration. I do think that will occur at some stage, probably not for the next few years, but the secular bull markets almost always end in a mania, and I don't think gold will be any different, and then eventually it'll be choked off by rising interest rates. Look at slide number 40. The only thing I don't like about gold right now is the fact that a lot of people hold it. Now, I don't think that they're excessively long. I certainly don't think that we're in any bubble or mania stage yet. But some of the other precious metals, which have a good record of tracking gold, and sometimes, often on a higher beta basis, in other words, are more volatile, look reasonably cheap. And one is platinum, and you can see this ratio. It has been lower if I go back even further, but I think it's more likely that we'll see platinum outperform gold a little bit over the next year or two. That wouldn't surprise me at all, particularly. Well, and it's all, I should mention that it's also more prone to supply shortage because most of the platinum comes from South Africa, and any strikes or power outages there can really ignite the platinum market, as we've seen before. As you'll see on page 41, that happened back in early 2008, and the price moved up very sharply. Platinum is an interesting precious metal, in my view, if you like the sector. And I do. also, slide 42 is the current leader in this cycle. Palladium has subsequently broken up to another new high, taking out its 2008 high. That's not the all-time high, which occurred some years earlier. But the palladium story is also one of, well, it's also one that can be prone to supply shortages. And you see there are some rumors that either Russia's stockpile is not as great as people had thought, or that they may actually make the tactical decision to hold back some supply. Copper. Copper is certainly an important industrial metal, not least for China, which has to import over 50% of its copper. That's more than for other industrial metals. You can also see that there's plenty of karma up in that $4 region, and I would expect copper to bounce around in this area for a while, but eventually break up to a new recovery high as growth continues in the progressing economy regions, and as the slower growth economies of the OECD countries gradually improves. Tin has been a leading industrial metal recently, but has run up to a level where we can clearly expect some resistance, and it's susceptible to some mean reversion towards its rising 200-day moving average. But there's certainly no global depression indicated by that chart, to state the obvious. Now, uranium. This is interesting. Uranium is the cheapest metal today. And if you look at that chart on slide 45, showing uranium over the last 10 years, first you notice that it's saucered around in this late 2008, 2009, and 2010 period to date. This looks like a base formation recovery, with the recovery just beginning to get underway. And I think this is very attractive metal at this stage. There are ETFs which trade hold physical uranium and physical uranium, and there are also of course uranium shares. But why has uranium lagged? And I think one of the important reasons is that gas prices have been so low. And one of the important reasons why gas prices has been so low has been the development of shale gas in the United States. And this is also now being developed in other countries around the world. So that's overshadowed uranium over the in recent years, and may continue to do so for a while longer. But shrewd long-term investors usually try to buy when markets are out of fashion, and I think that more and more people are likely to regard uranium as an attractive recovery candidate over the medium to longer term. And I can only see an increase in the number of nuclear power reactors over the next many decades. Now, looking at the crude oil chart, this will certainly be an influence on that slide number 46. This will certainly be an influence on the uranium price overall. Crude is range bound currently, as you can see, and the forecast from petroleum analysts is that it will remain range-bound for much of next year. I think that's an extrapolation of the sideways trend, clearly, and I'm not so sure that it is justified. Certainly, one development, while natural gas prices are quite low, and with the shale gas development, I think that that will be a restraint on upside moves in the oil price. But of course, we have the weak U.S. dollar. I'm not sure how long the OPEC members will be happy to see their revenue in dollars devalued. But what I'm concerned about, and I feel it's a matter of not if but when, we get the next upward break in crude oil prices. Now, if we get, and I think it will happen at some point, most likely next year, but if we get crude oil prices moving gradually higher, that will not be too great a problem for the global economy. Another spike, such as we saw culminating in the peak in July 2008. If we got another period like the first half of 2008 with oil prices surging higher, that would certainly curb global GDP growth. The bottom line fact is that all previous spikes in crude oil prices have caused recessions, and I don't think that another spike would be any exception to that. And I think it will happen at some point, and when it does, it will be prudent to pare back one's equity portfolios really quite considerably. But that hasn't happened yet. But forewarned is forearmed, as they say. Now, the Rogers Commodity International Agricultural Index, slide number 47. You can see the base formation and base completion. Food price inflation would be a problem, and I think we are going to see food price inflation. We're seeing agricultural, or we're seeing commodity inflation generally. Again, partly the supply and elasticity meets rising demand theme, which goes back to goes back for at least a decade. We are also seeing turbulent weather conditions, which may indeed have something to do with global warming. A controversial subject, but what's not controversial is that it's played havoc with crop cycles, and that has reduced the supply of all agricultural commodities, and that's being reflected in some of the price rises that we are now seeing, and I think we'll continue to see. So that's a future problem. Let's go on to the next slide, number 48, where I talk about, now I'm into the summary slides. So, medium to longer term risks, and I don't want this to be a paranoid's charter, and it shouldn't be viewed as such, but we are going to see price inflation from industrial commodities and foods. The progressing economies are already experiencing inflation. It's very different. You know, nobody in the progressing economy world is talking about deflation and the Japan situation, or a slip into a Japan-type scenario. They're all talking about inflation. In the developing economies, and bondholders should take note of this, I think that we will see inflation, not wage inflation. I don't think we'll see property inflation again, because that bubble is still deflating. But we will see some commodity inflation, and the bond market won't like that. Or investors in bond markets, I should say, won't like that. And you'll notice I haven't mentioned deflation in here at all. We do have some pockets of deflation, but most of what we're seeing in the West is disinflation. In other words, moving down, as in house prices, from a highly inflated level to a less inflated level. But commodity price inflation, if it continues, and I think it will, it's just a matter of does it happen quickly or take longer, will put upward pressure on interest rates. There's another risk of trade protectionism. Those who don't understand history are destined to repeat previous errors. And I'm concerned about the competition for scarce commodity resources. Potential flashpoints of the South China Sea. We've also seen China cut back dramatically on its exports of rare earths metals. Will other countries take a cue from that? Because if you look at what's happened to the rare earth metals, prices have absolutely rocketed since China reduced its supplies. So will Russia, for instance, with its palladium, being the main supplier of palladium, or South Africa with platinum, OPEC with crude oil, it would be surprising if some producers didn't think that maybe they should make the commodity, make some of their supplies a little less available in the interests of higher prices. That's certainly happened before. And the other side of the coin is that a number of investors and speculators may well anticipate similar developments. I think that's one of the reasons why the uranium price and uranium shares have been appreciating recently. High-frequency algorithmic trading. People are saying that's responsible now for 70 to 80% of the trading volume on Wall Street. It's predatory because they are able to log their computers. They store their computers at considerable expense in the exchanges themselves. It's crowding out other buyers, and I think it needs to be reined in. I regard it as another weapon of mass destruction. Global warming. We can't afford to, I know it's controversial, but we can't afford to take the risks. That does concern me, and I think we are seeing the effects in agricultural prices, as I've already mentioned. Okay, current bull points. Monetary policy. This tends to trump most other factors in terms of stock markets, and it remains accommodative. The trend for interest rates is higher in the progressing economies, and they've got nowhere to go but up in the Western economies, but they're not yet a problem. So net it all out, and interest rates are still reasonably favorable for stock markets. In the progressing economies, for instance, you have negative real interest rates. They're below the rate of inflation. CPI inflation is low, but remember, food price inflation is coming, as is industrial commodity inflation. The progressing economies, most of them did not experience growth. They only saw growth, what's known as a growth recession, a slower rate of growth. The West's recovery is still in its early months, not another month now, currently 15 months old. Positive development. Household savings are rising in the West. That's a good thing. Governments keep exhorting consumers to spend more money, but that's very much a short-term emphasis. On a longer-term basis, decent savings rates are one of the pillars of a strong economy. Equity valuations are reasonable, but less so. They were an absolute bargain back in the fourth quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009. They're moderate today, but will move higher. Big bull point here for U.S. multinational companies and any other multinational companies that are leveraged to the global economy. Most of them are in great shape and performing well in stock market terms, as they should. So, our Fuller Money forecasts that the Asian resources and tech-led global stock market recovery has resumed. And I maintain, as I said in my presentation, I mentioned that I had also spoken at the Contrary Opinion Forum in 2008, and I said that we would see some base formation development and then should see a cyclical bull market of between 3 to 5 years. I think that's still the case. We're in the third year, entering the third year of that process, that period. But it may be foreshortened or punctuated by commodity price inflation. We have to watch out for that. And again, I've consistently maintained that the U.S. should avoid a double-dip recession with the help of progressing economies. A very important long-term forecast from Fuller Money is that the bull market in long-dated government bonds is ending. In other words, yields are going to range higher over the longer term, and that will put upward pressure also on corporate bond yields over the longer term. So I prefer equities. Slide 51, the next of three slides of these Fuller Money summary forecasts. I think that clearly the gold secular bull market is still intact, and I think it will end in a mania, but probably not for several years. And again, I've already mentioned the secular bull market for industrial commodities, and we have a cyclical bull market right now for agricultural commodities. in terms of overall equity performance, I very much like the progressing Asian and resources economy stock markets. I don't like the Western stock markets per se, but U.S. and European multinationals leveraged to the global economy have been doing well, and I think they should continue to do well, particularly those that are high yielders, and they're also benefiting from soft currencies, the euro and the U.S. dollar. Fuller Money themes remain, and these have been Fuller Money themes since at least 2003, gold and other precious metals since 2001. But in addition to Asian and progressing markets, that excludes Japan. I really won't like Japan until the monetary stimulus is stronger and the yen is weaker. But as you can see, they're listed there. Technology, healthcare, mining, agriculture, global infrastructure development. It's companies like Siemens in Germany, which I've often mentioned in Fuller Money, and dividend increasers. I think that as investors become less enamored of bonds, but they will still remain yield hungry, and this will push shares that are proven dividend increasers to a premium relative to other equities. So that's my presentation. I invite you to visit our website, and there are free areas. You can see our historic archives, and you may also be interested to know that the Fuller Money service includes a comment of the day, a full comment of the day for subscribers. We also have a daily audio, and we also have a state-of-the-art chart library, customizable chart library. The service is really for people, and most of our subscribers are institutional investors other people with a background in the financial services industry, and high net worth investors, private investors, people who like the discussion, the debate that occurs on this interactive site, the reports that we actually post, because it helps them to clarify their own investment thinking. Thank you very much, and good luck with all your investments.